So we're doing the biological macromolecules packet today, which pairs up pretty well with the lecture where we are in lecture. And most of this, you're doing different things, but most of this is testing, conducting tests for the presence or absence of certain chemicals, certain kinds of molecules, which is important within science in general, not just biology. You know, you have some sort of solution. You don't know whether something you're interested in is in there or not, so you could run a test to determine whether it is there. And if so, maybe even how much, so to speak. Not necessarily quantitatively, but qualitatively. Well, most of these tests are pretty straightforward. Do you remember what things you're testing for? What was the first one? Right, what tests for proteins?
Yeah, Bio-RET test.
Yes, the Bio-RET test. And that will, how do you know whether that's a positive test? What happens?
A change in color as well.
It is a change in color, but what does it turn into?
Purple.
A violet color, right. That one I'm not going to talk about because it's really just a matter of adding the stuff. It's pretty straightforward as written. What else do we test for?
Carbohydrates, monosaccharides.
Well, carbohydrates includes two of the tests. Because we test for starch, right, which is a carbohydrate. But that's its own test. What tests for starch?
IKI.
Yes, the IKI test. And IKI, by the way, is a chemical formula. It stands for iodine potassium iodide. And that one, also straightforward, just go ahead and do it. But it's real easy to tell a positive because it turns almost black in the presence of starch. And what other test? The Benedict's test, which also tests for a carbohydrate, but a different carbohydrate. Starch is a polysaccharide, right? As we discussed. So it's made of many monosaccharides hooked together via glycosidic linkages. But the Benedict's test tests for the presence or absence of monosaccharides in general. So not a specific substance. You already learned today that there's many different monosaccharides. But any monosaccharide will allow for a positive result with Benedict's reagent in the Benedict's test. And that's what I wanted to talk about just a second to explain the top of page 3 in your manual. Not only to explain it for the sake of today, but because we're going to talk about what's happening here much more, especially in Unit 3 in lecture. But Benedict's reagent, which is the blue stuff you have, and you have a bunch of different reagents here, but you should have some blue stuff, which is Benedict's reagent. It is a solution of mostly water, but also copper ions. And copper is Cu on the periodic table. So we've talked about metals and nonmetals, right? Most of these are metals because they're to the left of this diagonal. The metals that are on in the first two groups, each of those always forms an ion the same way. Everyone in group 1, this first column, always forms an ion by losing one electron to become positive 1 for the reasons we discussed in lecture. All of them in group 2 lose 2 to become positive 2 ions. But these ones in this range, many of these ones in this range, can form ions multiple different ways. So there isn't just one version of an ion for those so-called transition elements or transition metals. And copper is one of those. You can see on this little figure that there's a Cu2+ and a Cu1+. When you have a superscript with a charge, that means instead of the atom, you have an ion. Right? So there's a so-called, in words, you would call this a copper 2 ion and this a copper 1 ion. But when you have Benedict's solution by itself, the stuff that looks blue to us, it's just millions and millions of copper 2 ions. That's what makes it look blue to us, the presence of copper 2 ions. The reason it works as a test, a visual test, though, is because some or all of the copper 2 ions, Cu2 plus, can be turned into the other version of copper ions, copper 1 ions. And this brings up the important idea, which we're going to be, which is what I'm saying we'll repeat a lot in lecture, in Unit 3, of a redox reaction. Now that is a portmanteau, one word that's made out of two words hooked together. It's really short for reduction oxidation. And it's kind of good to make it into one word because it keeps the two together. And the reason that's good is because reduction always accompanies oxidation. You don't have just reduction or just oxidation. If you have either, then you have both. Either neither of them happens or they both happen. Now, this is a little bit confusing terminology at first, but I'll explain why it actually does make sense. Reduction and oxidation involve transfers of electrons. And what confuses people is that reduction, which you're used to thinking of as losing things, like reduction in weight, losing weight, for instance, reduction is the gain of electron, of an electron, whereas oxidation is the loss of an electron. But if you think about the charges, then the words make sense. Right? If you gain an electron, what is happening to your charge? Numerically, it's becoming reduced, right? So think of it that way. Receiving an electron reduces your charge from either neutral to negative or from negative to more negative. Okay? Oxidation is just the opposite. It's loss of electrons. And how we process energy from our food when we burn our fuels involves redox a lot. That's why we're going to be talking much more about it in Unit 3. But it's introduced here because it's the basis of how the Benedict's test works. And it's the presence of monosaccharides only. This does not have any change. It won't have a positive result for disaccharides, trisaccharides, or polysaccharides. In other words, the thing that causes the change has to be a monosaccharide by itself, not hooked to something else. Now, think back to what I said today in lecture. What has to be true for monosaccharides to be hooked together? Dehydration reaction has to happen, but what has to be true of the monosaccharides before that can even happen? No, that's involved. That's involved in what I'm trying to get at. Remember the versions of monosaccharides. What shapes do they have? Linear and ringed, and only the ringed forms can bind together, right? What's related to that, what is true of a linear form that's not true of the same monosaccharide in ringed form? Right. Only the linear form has a carbonyl group, which has the double bond, right? That's what we talked about in lecture. To form the ring, you have to get rid of that carbonyl double bond. Well, that double bond in any linear monosaccharide is the source of the electron that gets transferred if this test goes positive. All right? So, let me give you a couple more definitions besides reduction and oxidation. In any redox reaction, something is going to be reduced and something is going to be oxidized. That's why I meant when I said they go, you can't have just one happening without the other. That should make common sense to you, right? If you transfer an electron, it has to come from somewhere, it has to go from somewhere, go to somewhere. So the thing that is receiving the electron is becoming what? Reduced or oxidized? It's becoming reduced, the thing that receives the electron. But that thing that receives the electron is called the oxidizing agent. And that's because when it receives the electron, that has the effect of oxidizing the thing that's losing the electron, right? Because oxidation means loss of electron. So the thing doing the oxidizing agent, is the thing that becomes reduced by receiving the electron. Does that make sense? It's confusing at first, but it does make sense if you think about it. And conversely, the thing that actually becomes oxidized, which it does by losing its electron, is reducing something else, right? Because that electron goes to that other thing. So the thing becoming oxidized in a redox reaction is the reducing agent. You clear on that? It is confusing, but tell me if you're not clear. Yes, the thing that becomes oxidized, which means the thing that loses the electron, it's called the reducing agent because it has the effect of reducing something else that it gives the electron to. And the thing that becomes reduced, which is the thing that receives the electron, is called the oxidizing agent because it takes the electron from that something else, thereby oxidizing it. Okay, one of the electrons in the double bond of a carbonyl can easily be lost from that monosaccharide. Therefore, if it is lost, what is happening to the monosaccharide? In terms of redox. No, I said what is happening? Yes, it is becoming oxidized. It is not oxidizing. I mean, unless you use that verb intransitively. I thought you were using it transitively. It's less ambiguous to say that the monosaccharide is becoming oxidized, right? Because it's losing its electron. But I just told you that the thing becomes oxidized is called the reducing agent. Well, this is why monosaccharides in general are called reducing sugars. Because by becoming oxidized themselves, when they lose that electron, they are reducing something else. Does that add to the clarity or the confusion? Neutral? Okay. So this is what happens. If you have any monosaccharide, any of which will have a carbonyl if it's in the linear form. And remember, it is half of the time in the linear form because it's going back and forth many times a second between linear and ringed. So it doesn't matter whether it's glucose or any other monosaccharide, it's going to have a carbonyl and therefore an electron that it's likely to lose and become oxidized in the process. But what is going to take up that electron? Copper 2 ions or a copper 2 ion that is one of the trillions that are in the solution called Benedict's solution. Okay, so what is if that does happen, what is happening to the copper? It's being reduced. Right. It's receiving the electron from the sugar, and that's why the sugar is called a reducing sugar. It's able to reduce something else. It's reducing, in this case, copper. Now, the copper in the solution originally is copper 2 ions. Those are the blue. That's what makes it blue, right? If copper 2 gets reduced, it turns it into what? Copper 1, which is a lower number, a lower charge. That's why it's reduced. Even though it took on extra matter and took on an extra electron, it's gaining a negative, though. So that's why it numerically is reduced. Well, the reason this works as a test is that a copper 1 ions in solution make it look brick red, not blue. Copper 2 ions make it look blue. But there's also other colors like green and yellowish that can occur as well. So not only does this test allow you to tell yes or no whether there is a monosaccharide present in solution, and the answer is no if it doesn't change from that blue at all, yes if it changes at all, it also, though, tells you, at least qualitatively, how much is there. Because if you have two solutions and one of them turns it all the way brick red and the other one, the same amount, same volume, turns it yellowish, what that means is you don't have as much in that one that turned it yellow, right? What's happening at the molecular level is that some of those trillions of copper 2 ions are being reduced into copper 1, but you still have trillions of copper 2s left over because there weren't enough reducing sugars to give them all electrons. So it's some combination of colors. But the extremes are the blue you start with and the brick red that you'll see when you give it a lot of monosaccharide. So why then would this not happen if you had starch in there, which is also a carbohydrate just like monosaccharides are? Any ideas? Yeah. That's right. And they don't have double bonds because you have to link them together in the ringed form. Ringed forms don't have those carbonyls anymore, right? So it doesn't matter whether it's a disaccharide or bigger, a polysaccharide, they're all rings. Therefore, no carbonyl groups. Therefore, no available electrons to reduce the copper 2 into copper 1. So it'll just stay blue. It has to be monosaccharides unbound to anything else, just by themselves, because those are the ones that can flip back and forth between ring and linear. That all make sense now? Okay, well, the rest of it is pretty straightforward, but I just want to say a couple more things before letting you loose. One is that, well, actually, yeah, I'll start here. One is that in addition to these tests, you're doing some pH tests, and we talked about pH in lecture, so that should make sense to you, and you've probably used pH strips before, but it doesn't matter which one of these trays you use. They don't have a crowd over here waiting on these when there's another tray identical to it available. That doesn't take very long at all, so I don't care what order you do it in. You can start with that, but most of the time will be spent doing these tests. Now, there's a couple things that are important in the order of this. In order to use these tests, you have to know what a negative definitely looks like and a positive definitely looks like. And that's why you start with known substances, ones with labels that are on in your little trays. So for each of these three tests, you want to individually test two things at least to start with, two knowns. Based on the test, You choose your knowns. So for Benedict's tests, you want to choose something that you know does not have any monosaccharides in it, so that you can be sure you see what a true negative looks like. Don't just believe me that it doesn't change blue. Prove it to yourself. But also choose another substance with Benedict's test that you know has monosaccharides in it, so you can see a good positive. And similarly for the other two tests. Do something that definitely has protein for Biuret, something that definitely does not have protein. So that's six runs right there to get a good positive and a good negative for each of the three tests. Once you have that done, then you're ready to use the tests, which they are for what they're usually used for, which is to test unknown substances, which are the ones back here. Now, pay attention to the thing that says shake it before using. But notice that there's three columns here. An A column, a B column, and a C column, but there's four of each, A1 through A4 and so on. All the A's are different. So it depends, it matters which one you get, it matters to the test. It doesn't matter which one you pick up, but make sure you write down which A you get, which B you get, and which C you get. Okay, the number matters. But you want to use one of each of these. You're going to test for three different unknowns. One of the A's, one of the B's, one of the C's. Okay? The idea here is to try to figure out what is in each of those three bottles by using all three tests on each of the three unknowns. So if you say you have A2, you're going to run A2 in Benedict's, in Biuret, and in IKI test, and write down your results. You're going to do the same thing for B and for C. And then based on the positives and negatives of those results, you're going to try to figure out, by narrowing down the possibilities that are listed, what could be in those unknowns. And I can look up the answers. I don't know what they are at the moment, but I can look it up. So when you think you have a good guess as to what your A, your B, and your C are, tell me and I can tell you whether you're right. Is that all clear? Okay. Now the final thing, I think, is safety. You're using two different acids today, plus other chemicals. So before you do anything, as soon as I shut up, you need to don goggles and keep them on while you're doing all these tests. Okay? Keep your goggles on today. You should also wear gloves when handling the acids. Now there are two acids, as I said, one of which is already in your bin. That's much weaker acid. And that is okay as long as you're careful with it. Don't squirt it in each other's eyes or anything, but it's okay to work with that at your desk, at your table. The other acid is much stronger and much more dangerous, therefore. And that's why it's in the hood. And that's why it has to stay in the hood. So when you do that part, which you'll get to in the procedure, that's done over here. You don't take this acid back to your desk. You use it in here only. Now, you still have to do things with it at your desk, but you deliver the acid into the container under the hood. And use gloves, definitely, for that. And goggles. When it comes time to clean up, you're emptying all of your tubes into one of your waste beakers just to keep it there with you. But then you'll eventually put those into the chemical waste bottle that's in this. You don't have to scrub your tubes or anything, but you can give them a quick rinse, just each tube, put them back in your rack. But there's also a 12 molar HCl waste, this is very strong hydrochloric acid, so for that part of the experiment, you only use that for that one part. Put that in its own beaker as waste. All right? Any questions before we start? Then start.